Okay, great. As I had said, this is 10 of 10 in this cohort. We've done 15 of these cohorts, but we're going to start with a 16th one. And this one, we've been going through all of the aspects of developing a job training program. And if you're new on the call or haven't seen them all, you might go to our brownfieldstoolbox.org. It's brownfields-toolbox.org. And I kind of like the post-session scripts. We write a post-session notes, and they're all up there. And it often goes into more detail and has the websites that you can go to, and it's got all the URLs and everything we talked about. And often a lot of things we don't get to talk about, we put in those. So if you go to 15, cohort 15, and you can go, they're all numbered. It'll go from, in this case, from 150 to 160. It tracks you through everything we've done in this cohort, and it'll talk about the beginnings of recruitment and labor market assessments and curriculum and keeping your students, retaining them, employer relations. And today we're going to be talking about placing graduates. But before we do anything, the first thing we do is we talk about what's new in Washington. And Glo, do you want to give us the poop on what's going on?
Yeah, I talked to Rachel Congdon this morning. She's HMTRI's progress officer. She said that EPA anticipates that the next RFP will be published within the next week or two. She said that they recognize that this is a busy time of the year with the holidays, so should the RFP be published within the next couple of weeks, the funding opportunity will be open on grants.gov for a few extra days to accommodate for this. And she wanted me to thank everyone for their continued patience of the release of the RFP. She also wanted me to remind everyone that before it is released and in advance of the submission of everyone's proposal, now would be a great time to make sure that your organization's DUNS number is up to date and that the appropriate person within the organization who's going to be submitting the proposal is the authorized organizational representative. So that was the update from headquarters. From HMTRI, we just announced on the listserv the date for next year's annual environmental job development all grantee meeting. That's going to be held August 9 and 10, 2017, with travel dates on August 8th and August 11th. It's going to be in Alexandria at a different location this time, at the Crown Plaza Old Town, Alexandria. More information will be coming out, and the registration materials probably, guessing around the end of January or so. That's it from me, Mike.
Okay. Now, the All Grantees meeting is a great meeting, and as a member of the PLC, you get an automatic invitation to go. And all you have to do is get yourself to Alexandria, Virginia, right outside of Washington, and get yourself back. We serve a couple of meals or working meals. It might be the only real cost is your transportation there and home, and then maybe a dinner or two. You're on your own. So it's a great conference, and we have about 150 people. We have the assistant administrator there who will be new because of the new administration. We have all of the people in OBLR. That's the overall Brownfields organization within EPA. And all the regional coordinators will be there. So it's a great thing to go to, and all of the grantees. We may have one or two missing, and we have also some alumni that just come on their own because they enjoy this meeting so much. We really interact for 2 days. We have breakout sessions. We have a lot of networking going on, and it's a very informal, like these PLCs, where people get to know each other, and we've got a lot of good old friends who've come for, some have come for 15 years. They've sustained their program and recompeted for that long a period of time. And many are just thinking of it. And we usually take them under our wing, and we kind of do learning experiences as we do in, and will do in the next cohorts of the PLC. So you get some really good ideas. And even if by that time you will be accepted or rejected, whether you're accepted, it's absolutely necessary to go. If you're rejected, it's also very important that you go, and we'll be talking about that next year, how important it is, if you're particularly if you're starting out, and strategies that you could use to have a successful re-up. And that'll happen again next November. This is what happens every year. They tell us at the meeting it's going to be issued in November, and then it became mid-November, and then it slipped to December. Now they're talking about just before Christmas, which is typical of what they usually do, unfortunately. We're kind of hoping that it'll be delayed at least till after the holidays, but we'll see. My guess is it'll come out on Christmas Eve. They have no control in the grants office of when it comes out. It has to go through lots of vetting processes. They're very careful about the wording and the legalese of everything. So after Rachel is finished with it, it goes on to other levels and has to be reviewed and go through the legal department and the grants department, and then they release it when they're ready. So this isn't anything abnormal, this delay that many of you have wondered about. It has nothing to do with politics or anything else. It is just bureaucratic. It's not even bureaucratic delays. It's just the time it takes to get through. And there were some minor changes this year. Rachel has told us, go to last year's, which we've talked about in the past, and I always post it on the post-session notes. Go to last year's, and it's going to be almost identical with an added section, and it'll probably make it more clear for you. So I think you can follow that as a guide right now, and we've been talking about that as we go. My guess is that January 4th, when we have our next PLC, it'll be out. And then we're going to get down to business about actually writing that grant. And we're going to be talking about some landmines, things to stay away from, things that you should emphasize, and what you should be doing with respect to your grant. So that's what we have to look forward to in the next month. We know usually, and in the notes, I'm going to include, if we have time to talk about it, but it'll be in the notes, what you should be doing now. And we'll get to that a little later in this discussion. We always have questions between our PLCs that people have. And during the last week, after last PLC, we had a question of a prospective grantee that said, you know, we're not sure that we could fund OSHA construction when there are certain things you could, and we talked about this in the curriculum section, and we'll be talking about it again in January. You could fund certain courses with EPA money. This program is very small. It's only $200,000. So they require, and the money is supposed to be for doing EPA training. Well, the question that arose is, well, OSHA construction, particularly OSHA Construction 10, which most people have in their program, is not an EPA program. And they question, do we have to get that leveraged by someone else, or can we use EPA funds? And we talked to Rachel about it, and she said, oh, absolutely, you can use EPA funds, because it talks about personal protective equipment, it talks about health and safety, and if you're going to be doing deconstruction, or if you're going to be doing asbestos removal, you need to follow those construction guidelines on health and safety. So it's very important, and it's integral. And we'll talk about this when we talk about writing your grants. Anything that's integral and related to the work of remediation is an allowable cost to be paid by EPA. Those that are not are things like the life skills, if there's an anger management or some sort of presentation, financial literacy. It's when you think about it from a distance, it's pretty clear. If it has to do with financial literacy, soft skills, behavior, those types of things, child care, they're more socially oriented. So those you need to get leveraged. Those that have to do more with health and safety, if you're going to be, think about it, if you're going to be doing any kind of job in remediation, it could be elevated platforms or harnessing or labeling. These are OSHA courses, but you've got to do that at some point when you're doing some remediation or cleanup work, then it becomes allowable. And that's kind of the rule of thumb you want to use. So that was one of the questions we had. And of course, we always have the question of what about this RFP? And Glo just answered that. We also tell people, just look at last year's and it's going to be almost dead on. So that's the best place to get a head start of what you're going to be talking about. So what we're going to talk about today, and it kind of follows up on what I was just listening to and Glow was listening to, the leveraging. There was a big webinar and it was talking about leveraging brownfields. Well, brownfields is so big, and it's one thing to clean up, and then what happens after you do the cleanup, and you have these huge infrastructure projects that we were talking earlier today about building highways. These are $500 million, $1 billion projects. Each state gets block grants, and the states have their own project, and there's also discretionary Tiger grants. Well, how does that relate to us? And it's important to think about funding, and particularly when you're trying to leverage or trying to find employers. Government gives out huge amounts of money. This program is really an exception. This is $200,000 that's given out directly from a federal agency. That's very rare in government. They give these huge amounts of money to states. The states have a project, and they're giving that money to general contractors. These are the large environmental firms. What do the large contractors do? They're national firms. They're very big, even in the state. They're doing many projects. Well, what do? They subcontract. So they'll go to a remediator. That now we're starting to talk about the people we need to relate to. Well, who do the remediators use? Well, they often go to a manpower firm. So we're really where the rubber meets the road as far as employment. You could say we're at the bottom of the chain of all this funding, but we're really where the actual work gets done. And when you talk about placing people, you don't want to work up the chain. You want to work as far down on the chain as you can and work your way up. So that's something to keep in mind. Don't think about, the only reason you need to go to the state and you need to go to the generals, and the reason you need to go to those bigger contractors is to find out who are they subbing to, and down the food chain, who are going to be the guys that are actually going to get their hands dirty, who are going to be doing the work, and who's going to be hiring them. And that's the way you want to approach your, not only as we first talked about, your labor market assessment, developing your relationships with employers. That's what you've got to address, and not so much on the big fish, but the little fish. And the way EPA program is set up, they give you 2 years and into that third year to put on your cohorts. Might be three training sessions, might be more than three, might be 20 or 30, 20 a class, maybe a little more, a little less. They give you that last year. These used to be two-year grants. They extend them to three because they want you to place all your graduates or as many as you can. And last year they had a 70%. They wanted a 70% placement rate. They've on and off talked about bringing that up to 80. And believe it or not, we've got people with 100% placement. And the next question, before you say, ouch, how do you do that? We have to look back at the advantages that our graduates have. They've got certifications anywhere from 4 or 5 all the way up to 10 or 12 or 14 certifications. The employer has to pay for those certifications if they get someone off the street. They get a screened employee. They've got someone who's gone through 280 or so hours of training. They know that they've come to class on time. They know they're disciplined. They know they're deserving. And it doesn't matter whether there's an ex-offender or a woman or a person that just things have not gone right for them, they're unemployed. The fact that they've gotten through this program gives them a credibility that they won't get from someone off the street. Plus, it gives them someone who's already trained and has certifications, and they've been able to get through the program. So if you get through the program, and we talked about that earlier, that goes back to your recruitment process and your screening process that is extremely important. So how do we find these employers, and how do we get them to hire our graduates? And the first thing you want to think about in general, and probably the most important piece of advice that can be given, is engage the employers as much as you can in your program. Get them to bond with your program. And of course, first you have to identify those employers. And that came out of our discussion on labor market assessment. It shows you how important labor market assessments are. What you need to do in labor market assessment, not look in...
Mike, are you still there?
Hello?
I think we
yeah,
just lost
you stopped
Mike.
Talking. Yeah,
yeah,
I think we did. So we should call in again?
Yeah, I think we should just call in again.
That's funny.
Well, do you know
not,
what?
You know,
he
I
might
think
call
this
in.
Happened one other time when Mike got somehow disconnected. This is
Glo.
Oh,
hey,
so
Glo.
I'm going to step away from the phone and call him from another
okay.
phone and see what's up, okay?
Yep.
You
both sit tight. Both sit tight.
Talk.
Okay.
Okay.
There he is. That's probably him.
I'm sorry. I'm back online.
Okay.
I
good, Mike. There you are. No problem.
I was crowing about how we never have glitches and we just had a glitch. So.
No problem.
So I don't know when you lost me, but I came up with this screen that had me do a log on again. So I don't know. I lost the signal. But anyway, we're back at, and I'm not sure where I got cut off, but how do you engage your employers in your program? And that's the most important thing.
Yep.
You got to get them into your program, and you want them on your advisory committee. We talked about that early in your labor market assessment. Not only identify who the employers are, but the question you ask is, would you be interested to be on our advisory committee? Oh, I'm pretty busy. Well, could you be a guest speaker?
Mm-hmm.
Even better, can you be a guest lecturer? And it's not so important to what they know technically. It's that they're getting into your classroom. They
yeah.
get in your classroom and they see 20 guys who are polite, screened, eager. And the more time they spend in your classroom and after class, when the guys come up and ask them questions or you have coffee, they get to bond with these guys and they get to know them. And often they're hired before they graduate because they can relate and they get to choose the pick of the litter. So it's definitely in the benefit of the employer to get in that classroom. And the more you can get in the classroom, the better. Now, during your assessment process, you have to try to figure out what employers are most likely to hire your students. What are they doing? And it's part of your recruitment of employers and your labor market assessment. You want to find out, do they hire these kind of people? Do they need them? What certs do they need? If they had them, would you be interested? We had a case early on in East Palo Alto. It turned out this was a tank manufacturer. He was ready to hire all the graduates. We've had situations in Detroit where, same thing, they're doing tremendous amount of deconstruction in Detroit. We'll hire whoever you can graduate if they've got these credentials. If there are fewer jobs available, they might be a little more pickier. It gives you a chance to work with these employers and also find out, are they sympathetic to ex-offenders? Do they have quorums on the type of work they do? Are there certain courses they want? So again, and if you can get an employer to come into your program and do guest lecturing or just guest speaking or talking an awareness about the program and what they do and what they're looking for, that's plenty. It gets them into it. So you want to use them as much as possible. The second biggest source of potential employers that will hire your students are alumni. You wouldn't believe how many of our graduates that come of our grantees who have graduates say some of our best employers are alumni.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes on two levels. One, the employer sees how good he was, that he came out of your program. The second thing is that some of the grantees get promoted very quickly and they become supervisors. So you want to work on and indoctrinate your grantee, your participants, that when they get out of the program, and we're going to talk about this a little bit about tracking, you want to inbred in them to come back to the program. You are part of the program forever. We're not pumping you out and you're on your own. You're part of this great group of people, and we do this with our grantees. Once you're a grantee, it doesn't matter whether you don't get a grant the next year or 2 years later or 5 years later. We have people who have been out of the program for 7 or 8 years, and we still hear from them. So they're part of it. It's kind of a club, and you want to get them to come back to talk to your graduates again. They might go to, and the reason is they may go to work for someone and they need some people, and the supervisor or the employer may go to them and say, you know, we need some more guys. Can you recommend anyone? Well, yeah, I've been to alumni nights. I've hung out with these guys. We're on the same Facebook page. I would recommend Josh or Joe or Denise. So this is a very important to keep not only your employers engaged in a program, keep your alumni engaged in the program. The other things that many people use, now these are the most effective. Many people leave it up to the WIB or the WIOLA, that's the Workforce Investment Board, where they screen and they also place. It's okay and it works, but it's probably not the best method. But these Workforce Investment Boards and job centers have access to many, many employers, and they probably have a broader contact list than you'll ever have in terms of people in fields that aren't directly involved in environmental remediation. It might be UPS, it might be FedEx, it may be a trucking company, and they need some people who have HAZWOP or transportation of hazardous materials. You might never be able to find that employer, but they know because people, part of their job is to find out with their potential big list of employers in all different fields, are there any positions or people with certain skills that you could use? And they might say, they might have two positions open for a hazardous waste driver or a handler or someone who's got HAZWOP certification. So you don't want to exclude the Workforce Investment Board. And we've talked on almost half of our sessions about how important it is to have a WIB person or WIOLA person, that's the new legislation, on your advisory board so that they're also aware of who you're putting out, the credentials that they have and what they can do. So that's those are two major sources of where you could find potential employers. Of course, a third one that's very important and it's more elusive is the networking, particularly in associations. Get involved in associations. Now, next year, in December 7th in Pittsburgh, there's going to be a National Brownfields Conference. It's not this job training program like ours, and it's going to be in August. This is everyone, and there's several classes of people. There's the financiers, there's the city governments and all the governments who have the brownfields. There's the job training people, there's the technical people, the remediation people, and they have a big display area, which we have a booth there, along with all the remediators and the cities. And it's a great place to network and just go booth by booth and find out who might be hiring people. And often all the national remediators are on that. And you can always get a business card and get back to them and say, we have some graduates. And most of the biggies know about this program. And they're getting contracts on a national basis and they need local people often. So you want to go to the national association definitely. And the reason being is you want to get your contact list of national people, which may not be on your local list, who are hiring people all over the country in specific occupations, particularly in remediation, who have credentials. So you want to go to Brownfield 17, but that's not the December, and we'll be talking about that later. There are local brownfields, and probably the most comprehensive one is the Florida Brownfields Association. They have that every year in the fall, and that's an excellent one because it's regional, but it's got every employer that's involved. They've got 300 employers who attend this. They all have a stake in remediation or their governmental organizations. They're not going to go there to this meeting unless they're involved in remediation. Well, you're involved in people who provide the remediation people with talent. So we've had years where at least two of our brownfield grantees in the surrounding region around Florida, which includes about four states that come in, they've even sent graduates to this meeting, and they had a special job session. They had a little room where people could go and meet employers. They were also able to let some of these students network with some of the employers. So that's more of a regional one. That's the Florida Brownfields. But many states have Brownfields associations, and you might check to see and just Google your state and Brownfields Association, find out when their meeting is, and see if you could attend without paying. Many of them have fees to support their organization, but you're an educational organization, and particularly an EPA grantee, you could probably get in without cost. You might even have a session. So it's very important to attend these conferences if you can, particularly the local ones for placing local graduates, and then the national one for national programs. I would not overlook temp firms, and that's kind of an off-the-wall thing. When we first started, we never thought temp firms might be a good employer, but they may even be good on your advisory committees, because temp firms, earlier I talked about this hierarchy of employers that went from the big guys down to the contractors, to the subcontractors, and this is not a field where you can just hire people off the street. So there are temp firms that specialize in people with special skills, and one of those special skills comes from graduates in our program. So you need to find the temp firms that specialize in environmental workers with credentials, and certainly bring them on board, because they're most likely to need your graduates, particularly if they're certified. There's another interesting twist on that, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. It's about ex-offenders. People have the impression that ex-offenders are difficult to place. And it's interesting that in this program, that has not been so much the case. I recall people in Kansas City, a grantee there said, oh, we specialize in ex-offenders and we do well with them. And I said, could you explain why you were able to place them so easily? And he said, well, first of all, they're certified, they're credentialed, they've been through the programs, all the things we talked about, they've been screened, they're not going to get in your program unless they deserve to be in there. Their offenses may be very minor, it may have been some sort of a drug issue, maybe something they did when they were very young. Some programs, you can even bond them. You're certainly not going to be trying, it's very difficult with people with major offenses, and that goes to specialty people like Safer Foundation. I'm not sure if they're on the line, but there are several organizations that work very specially with ex-offenders. Many of our programs work with them. There are many employers who are very sympathetic to working with ex-offenders, particularly in the construction business, which this is very similar to construction, the types of jobs, the length of those jobs, the types of people they hire. They have to be able to be outside or physically capable. Many of the firms have been, a lot of the remediation firms, as I talked about, who are actually doing the work, were often started, many of them were started by people who have been ex-offenders. Those firms are not so concerned about mistakes that someone may have made in the past. They're more concerned about, can you do the job? Can you work with a team? Are you deserving? All of the attributes our graduates have. So I would not be deterred in any way. As I said, in some states, New Jersey, I believe you can get state assurance bond even on people that you need to. Most likely you wouldn't need something like that. But you definitely need to go down that path if you can, and look at those contractors that are say, it doesn't matter if you screen them properly and they know their business and they're hard workers and they may be better suited for certain jobs than someone I would find off the street. We also have in many states like Illinois and some of the others the movement to ban the box, where you cannot discriminate against something if they've got some sort of criminal record on the first interview. Now, if they're going to be doing something, going to someone's homes and there's an offense that in larceny or something, there may be something else that might disqualify them, particularly if they don't have a bond. There are certain offenses that it just might not work. There might be some offenses that it would work. You're going to be working outdoors, or you're going to be working on highways, you're under bridges, or you're going to be doing demolition or deconstruction work, that's fine. So you need to to consider all those things. One of the reasons I had brought this up after I talked about temp firms, it's an interesting little quirk, but often if you have ex-offenders you want to place, you may look to temp firms, because often temp firms don't make that discrimination, and they could go to work for the temp firms where there might be something in a company that would, some internal policy that would keep them from hiring an ex-offender. But in the temp firms, they're kind of indemnified by the temp firm. So often you might have an ex-offender who goes to work for a temp firm. The downside of that is we've had situations where they get out of your program, they go to work for the temp firm, they do a great job. Then the employer wants to hire them. And then they find out in the full application for permanent employment that they've got some offenses on their record, and they run into some issues there. So that's probably the negative, but the positive is there that makes in cases where they may not be able to get employment in full-time in certain firms, they certainly could qualify in the temp firms. So I want to quickly talk about, and we're a little bit over, but the tracking, and part of that tracking is making sure that your graduates are safe when they're employed. You put a lot of effort and investment in your graduates. You want to make sure that they go to places that are going to respect them and not put them in a dangerous situation. As part of your screening process of employers and word of mouth from your tracking information of people who have gone to work for firms, you've got to find out if how they're treating their employees. If they're not treating them respectfully, the respect they deserve, or putting them in dangerous situations to save money, or not following the rules, you need to basically blacklist them. It's your responsibility, particularly if you're involved in placement. So, and how do you get that information? Often it's from your graduates. And you want to get, and this is part of tracking, you want to find out, you find out someone left the company, and you have a personal interview with him. He said, to be honest, he wanted me to do stuff. He didn't want me to put a safety harness on, or he didn't want to spend the time to do proper labeling, or he wanted to put me in a dangerous situation, or he didn't get me work boots, or any number of issues. And you need to say, okay, we're going to find you a different job, but you need to also mark down that employer and who he was and make sure that no one else goes to work in that situation. So that comes into this whole area of tracking. And how do you track your students? And that's one of the most difficult jobs. And most grantees will say probably the most difficult part of the placement and tracking is the tracking. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people will get the job, and then you'll lose sight of them, and they won't respond. Well, there are certain things you can do. You really want to have alumni nights, and I talked about that earlier. You want to have your alumni come back for alumni nights. You want to have them come back for graduation. You want to have them come back as guest speakers. You could say, well, can you come back and tell us what it was like, your experience after you graduated? Things like that. You want to have them bond with your program just as the employers bond with the program. And they're going to find that when they graduate and they come back, not everyone stays in the same job the rest of their career. They may leave. They may get promoted. And the more they may network, they may find coming back to an alumni night or a social night that someone who else is alumni said, you know, I got this great job, and they're looking for more people. And your graduate may go to him and say, can you put in a good word for me? And say, yeah, I will. Why don't you come on over and fill out an application? So it's a great way. All of the people in that room will be people who are going to graduate or want to graduate or maybe starting out and graduated. And they're all going to interact with each other, and you're going to get tremendous synergisms, and you're going to get a lot of interest in the room. And when you do that, it's a informal way of tracking your students, who's going where. Now, many of our grantees that works really well is they're using, of course, social media. And whether it's Facebook or Twitter, they always invite them to graduations, job openings. And we've got some strategies that in terms of tracking students that may be very useful in terms of setting up Facebook pages, having everyone on its Facebook pages or have a new email. Of course, everyone has always suggested when they do an email, make sure that their login ID is respectable and not from what their street name was. You have them have something that's more of a respectful, same with Facebook, but have them, if you have a grantee program Facebook page where you could announce job openings, or even if you decide to use Twitter and you could announce an announcement, or there is an announcement on a Facebook page of potential openings or someone's looking for it. You may have an employer that says, well, I need someone in July and I need more than you can graduate. Well, you could say, well, I could post this on our webpage and I can get you a pool of people who have been through this program and are just as, not only as credentialed as the people we have, but they've got experience to boot. So one of these reasons and fallouts of tracking is the ability to keep in touch with your students. Just as we keep in touch with our old grantees and our old PLC members, our lists are 300, 400, 500 or even 1,000 on the listserv. You want to keep that conversation going because people, it's just not about placing them in that first job and leaving them or just leaving them. You want to do that. Another thing you can do is refresher training. In addition to offering placement service for graduates, doesn't matter if you graduated this year, last year, or 4 years ago, come back to us and we can help you with whatever resources we have. We could also have refresher training. Now, on refresher training, you might be able to charge a fee because the grant is basically over. That's an acceptable thing to do. You could charge a certain $100 or $200 for a refresher. But at the same time, nice thing about refreshers is you're tracking at the same time. So these are all these strategies that you can do to track your students, and they all together will help you be more successful than someone who just lets them go. Also, keeping up your relationships with employers is extremely important because your employer, you go back to, and particularly if he's hiring multiple students, you could go back to him and say, well, we'd like to keep track of our students, and can you tell us how so-and-so is doing? And you might say, well, he left 6 months ago, or he got a better job, or oh, we promoted him 3 times. So you want to note every one of these cases. In fact, you want to keep a log, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, job openings, or the employer's report. You want to keep a track of what's happening to your graduates. So I'm going to, everything I've said basically leads down to networking and personal engagement and bonding with your employers and with your students and all of them interacting. And I think that's the key to making all of this work. One of the things I didn't talk about is in your organizational structure, we find that the best graduates or the best placement rates and tracking is when you have someone who is solely responsible for that. Everyone in the organization, now you have to remember, the purpose of this whole grant is placing those students. So everyone in the program, from the trainers to the administrators to everyone, needs to be in line that our mantra and our purpose here is to get good jobs for our students. The problem is if you don't have someone who's charged big responsibility, if you don't place, they're the blame. You're going to get someone who's more likely to place more students. So you have to have a responsible party. Now, that party may be doing other things in an organization, but he's got to know, and everyone in that organization knows that he is in charge of working with employers and working with students and getting those students placed. If you don't do something like that and say, congratulations, you're graduated, good luck finding a job, it's not going to work. It just isn't. And your placement and your tracking and your keeping your students in a good job is going to be much lower than if you have someone particularly assigned to that project. So I don't want us to take you too much time over this. I'm going to put in the post-session notes all of these things we talked about, but then also things you should be doing now. And between now and when the RFP comes out, and between when the RFP comes out and the 4th of January, when we'll get to talk again to each other, if you have any questions, just email me or GLO, M. Senu at AOL. When you get the post-session notes on Friday, it'll have my address, and we'll get those answered, any questions you might have. I was talking kind of fast. Sorry for the interruption during this session, but does anyone have any questions that they don't want to forget between now and when they get a chance to email that question in?
Yes. I just wonder, this is again Allison from Youth Build Boston. Do you have a sense when the RFP is released, roughly when it'll be due? Is that usually 4 or 6 weeks out?
That's about it. And we used to think, gee, they should give them about 90 days, but they're not going to give you 90 days. They're going to give you, they were talking about December to February.
Only thing that she said about that, she didn't give me any time frame. All she said is that they would allow an extra few days on grants.gov due to the holidays and everybody being busy, but she didn't indicate any kind of lead time for the submission date.
My feel is mid-February, maybe later February, depending on when this actually comes out. Glo, do you have that same kind of vibration?
That's usually about the way it works, about the right length of time.
Because they have to, the procedures, what they do is they have to get them all in. They have a contractor go through them, screens for your eligibility. Then they have to have meetings. And they like to give these things out in May or June. And it takes that long to go through all the stuff they have. I'm really hoping that they're going to wait till after the holidays, but we'll see.
Yeah.
I would go to last year's and put the email, the address on that in the notes, and you can go there. I could even attach it to the notes for those who may not have it. I would also think about things you could do now. And for those of you who weren't on previous sessions, I think the things that take time, and I'll mention these in the notes, are the things you want to do now, between now and even the downtime. If you can schedule or get involved in a city council meeting, just ask your city council, and one of the things we ask people to do is get involved in local government. Just ask if you could have a minute to announce your intentions to submit a EPA, Environmental Development Job Training Program. The mayor will love it.
Mm-hmm.
City council will like it, and you document it and put it in your grant. You would be amazed at how few people do this, and when that's in a prominent place on your grant, it gives you plus, 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 plus. Public meetings are essential. If you can't do city council, try to get a community meeting in the target group that you plan doing. Go to a church and just ask the minister that someone would like to announce that we're going to try to submit a proposal. We may not get it this year to develop a job training program. Record it and say you had public meetings and put it in your grant. That takes some time, though, so that's got to be done this time of the year. If you haven't done it yet, it's a good time to do it. Develop your relationships with employers. Again, this is a bad time to be doing that, but it takes time. So you need to start, if you haven't already, find out who your real employers are going to be. Try to find some manpower firms. See if you get someone on your advisory committee. You want to get your advisory committee going. That takes some time, because you're going to want to put them in your grant, and you're going to need some recommendations. So those take time. Also, go to grants.gov, and you could do that on Christmas Day or between the couple days after Christmas when you've eaten too much turkey and you've got a lot of time, some time on your hands, or you want to get away from the family. Tell them I need to do some EPA work. Go to grants.gov and just check it out to see what you're going to be needing to do. So with all that, any other questions?
No, that was very helpful.
Okay. Well, I've taken too much time, but we'll be reconvening. We'll be doing same time, same place, same phone number on January 4th. So mark your calendars. And meanwhile, we can correspond in between. So y'all great holidays. And
Thank you. Bye.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Happy holidays.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good holiday.
Okay.